This podcast is supported by Washington.org. Washington, D.C. offers visitors so much to explore. Just ask Dayo, who shared her experiences from a recent visit.
What was your favorite food all weekend?
The Ethiopian food at Sihei.
And the first place you would visit again?
The bookstore, Little District Books.
What did you appreciate the most?
Really just like the genuine kindness of everyone that I encountered this weekend.
Why should people visit D.C.?
Well, D.C. is a place with such a thriving culture.
Washington, D.C. has something for everybody. Plan your next trip at Washington.org.
You got a fast car. I got a job that pays all our bills.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your bigger house in the suburbs of music, news, and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica.
You and me find it. I got no plans. I ain't going nowhere. Take your fast car and keep on driving.
You all know what that is. That is Fast Car, Tracy Chapman, the original. Luke Combs, of course, covered that song last year. It became a very, very big hit. And a couple weeks ago on the Grammys, Luke played it with Tracy Chapman. The rare good example of a Grammys moment of a cross-genre, cross-generational performance that reveals something about both participants. If you've been listening to podcasts, you know we've talked about the Luke Combs version, which doesn't add a lot to the Tracy Chapman version. That's probably for the best because the Tracy Chapman version is about as indelible a vocal performance as I think you could have. Her version of Fast Car is one of the defining songs of the late 80s. It led to a whole number of accolades. She won Grammys in 89 and also was successful enough. She released a few albums subsequently, but successful enough to retreat from the limelight and still be loved and revered for, at minimum, this one thing. In the course of thinking about Tracy Chapman in anticipation of the Grammys and after the Grammys, I did a lot of reading about how Tracy Chapman was covered in her day in the late 80s. And I came across the Rolling Stone cover story in 1988, a very uncharacteristic cover. Rolling Stone in that era really put rockers, boomer rockers, men, bands on the cover to have a young black woman who was on her first album on the cover of Rolling Stone at that time was really striking. And if you read that article, so many of the themes that have come up in the last few weeks of conversation around Tracy Chapman about her, the way that she approached her music making, the seriousness of purpose, the reluctance to embrace the spotlight, etc., that was all there in 1988. And I said, you know what? I got to track down the person who wrote this story and spent all this time with Tracy Chapman in 1988. So this week on Popcast, we're going to talk to Steve Pond. Steve was a rock journalist, a music journalist for many years, now works at The Wrap, covering Hollywood and the awards, all the big award shows and the predictions, et cetera, et cetera. But back in the 80s, Steve was writing big Rolling Stone stories and got an assignment to spend a few days following around and peppering with questions Tracy Chapman and those around her. So calling into Popcast, it's Steve Pond. Steve, welcome.
Thanks, John. Happy to be here.
I'm happy to have you for a couple reasons. So Steve wrote about music for more than 20 years before now becoming the awards editor at The Wrap, switched over to film. But Steve, in your background, what are we talking about here? Is it like a Wurlitzer? You got a huge jukebox. So you haven't let go of the music altogether. What is that? And more to the point, more crucially, what's in it?
Okay, what it is a 1961 Seberg, and it has 80 45s in it from an extensive collection of 45s that I've accumulated over the years. And I swap records in and out. It cost me $200 a very long time ago, and then it costs a lot more than that to get it fixed up to where it's still running, but it is. So
also a great argument to live in Los Angeles or a place that's not New York, so you can have room to have something like that. All right, Steve. As I was just joking with you before we started recording, one of my main takeaways from your piece, besides the fact that like everything that Tracy says and did in this piece seems to presage what would come for the next 35 years, you went everywhere. You were in at least three different cities. This is a different mode of music journalism that I think a lot of our younger readers are used to, but you really We're in the trenches. Can you tell me a little bit before getting into the piece itself? Can you talk a little bit about what it meant to do a Rolling Stone cover in that era, and how, what was the planning like that went into it?
This one, I remember it came up very quickly. The album came out in April, I think, of 1988. We didn't run a review of the album until June of that year. And I wrote the review, which was a combination review of her album and the first album by Tony Childs. So it wasn't like she even was getting a lot of attention. And then all of a sudden, boom, you know, it had to do with maybe the Nelson Mandela concert where she sort of stole the show. But all of a sudden, Rolling Stone said, we want Tracy Chapman on the cover. Which, for somebody who had just put out their first album, that was a really big deal. So there was a sense of, okay, we're going to do something we don't usually do, which is put a brand new artist on the cover because we love her and we think she's important. And so they didn't want to sit down with her for an hour or two and write the story. It was like, she's on the road. The idea was to follow her for a few cities. But then they also said, and before you talk to her, go to Connecticut and go to her old prep school and talk to the teachers there. And so it was a lot of moving around.
Yeah, there's at least four locations in this.
Yeah, it was like Connecticut, and then I flew to Atlanta, and I was with her when she played Atlanta, and then she played Philadelphia, and then it ended with her playing Cleveland, which was her hometown, which I think was sort of the plan, was to end with her going back to her hometown.
I mean, a very ambivalent return to her hometown,
yeah,
it seems.
Yeah, it wasn't like, oh, I'm so happy I'm back. I mean, she got on stage and said, I don't have many good memories about this place, or something to that effect.
One of the things we learn in your story, for folks who are not familiar with Tracy Chapman's backstory, from Cleveland, or from the Cleveland area, got a scholarship to like a private school in Connecticut, went there for most of for high school, then was at Tufts for college, was singing, did some protest related singing, and sort of through an amazing pachinko ended up playing very big stages very quickly. One of the things that you go back to time and again in this piece is Tracy Chapman's reluctance. She is not glowing in the spotlight of fame. She is trying to duck it at almost every moment in this piece. I wonder if you could tell us about that, what that was like in real life, and also how did that compare? Because I'm sure you wrote many other stories about famous people at the top of the charts. How did it compare to other folks that you'd spend similar time with?
I can't remember anybody who was quite so reluctant to embrace her success. I mean, I certainly dealt with that. You know, I did an early REM story where they were sort of at the transition between playing theaters and arena and basically basketball stadiums, which they hated. So I've dealt with ambivalence, but I think with this one, we were getting her right at the point where very suddenly, she was becoming very big, and she was very recognizable. So I was with her for maybe 4 days. Everywhere I went with her, she would be recognized. And it was this same thing, and I think it's in the lead of my story. It was this same thing that would happen every time, which is somebody would say, are you Tracy Chapman? And the first thing you would see in her face was a look of, oh God, go away. You know, it was like she wanted to say, no, I'm not. And then she would smile. And then because she was very shy, she would sort of cover her mouth every time she smiled. And then she would kind of look down and say, yeah, I am. I spent a few days watching her at a point where this was starting to happen. And she really didn't know if she wanted it. And yet at the same time, her music was being heard, which obviously is something she wanted. It was a master class in ambivalence.
Did you find that she was different sort of offstage and onstage, or was some of that reluctance also how she carried herself while performing?
It's funny because I went back and I reread my story after you reached out to me, and I had forgotten that it was such a big deal to people that she didn't talk to the audience on stage.
Mm.
She would just go out. She would just have an acoustic guitar and she would play for about an hour and she would say virtually nothing in between songs. And people are used to, if it's a person standing on stage with an acoustic guitar, they're going to tell you stories in between the songs. They're going to try to connect with you. And she didn't. I mean, she's basically said, here are my songs. And that really bothered a lot of people back at the time. And I had sort of forgotten about that. But it came back to me when I read the story is that, oh, yeah, that was like people wanted to feel like she was their friend and people wanted to feel like she was going to share with them. And she was a very private person, you know, and I found it in the interviews, even when she loosened up with me, she was never going to talk about much about her personal life or, oh, yeah, this song's about this experience I had. I mean, she kept things to herself and you saw it on stage as well.
One thing that is brought up in your piece is that is both her natural disposition, but it is also something of a choice. Like her manager talks about that choice of her not to speak in between songs, not be overly chatty, as a modality to set her apart in a way, to make clear, yes, these songs are a little bit different than what you've been hearing recently, but also this person is a little bit different. You get that vibe as well.
Yeah, very much so. And I mean, her manager was Elliot Roberts. He was not a guy who would be managing new acts. I mean, he was the manager for Neil Young and Joni Mitchell. And when I talked to Elliot, he said he admitted that he encouraged her not to speak, that, you know, a lot of what he was trying to do, I think, was sort of create a mystique. And he would say, it's not that this isn't who she is, but yes, we have a plan. And yes, we're carrying it through. And yes, it's really working.
I'm struck by your description of your review of the album as being part of a double review of new albums by not particularly well-known singers. And then 4 months later, obviously, you're arriving with this cover story. But I'm struck because David Kirschenbaum, who produced the record, gave an interview to Billboard recently. And one of the things that he said that I think maybe gets lost a little bit in the historical fuzz is that in its moment of 1988, this was not what most new artists sounded like. This is not what most young acts that had signed to major record labels, this is not the music they were making. And we think of Tracy Chapman as a perennial. We think of Tracy Fast Car as part of the fabric of great American songcraft. You don't necessarily remember that in its moment, it was a bit of a risky or radical proposition. I wonder if you could talk about that moment in pop music, 86, 87, 88, and what Tracy was doing, how it sat next to other things that were actually very popular at the time.
That was a point where music with lots of synthesizers and bigger arrangements, and she was much sparser and less so in a way on the album than when you saw her live, because with live, it was just her and a guitar. But the album itself was very sparse. And it wasn't, you listen to it now, it doesn't sound like a folk album, but it was a very sparse pop album. I mean, it had an a cappella song on it. It wasn't the kind of thing, if you're a new artist trying to get noticed, I mean, I suppose to not sound like anybody else at the time is good, but it wasn't the kind of thing that I think radio necessarily would have gravitated to. I mean, it's interesting you talk about Fast Car as being part of the American song. It became known because it was so damn good. It was basically inescapable. You couldn't listen to that song and not think, wow, this is something new and remarkable. And hell, we thought the same thing 2 weeks ago when she did it on the Grammys. It holds up amazingly well. And it was a combination of she sounds different, she looks different, and boy, is she good.
And I also feel like Fast Car, I mean, look, some of this just boils right down to craft and skill. But Fast Car does the thing that I think a lot of casual listeners tend to say about singer-songwriter music or folk music or acoustic music, which is, oh, it gets rid of all the BS. It just strips it down to the core. And I think people often mistake that inherently for a virtue. But I've heard plenty of stripped down music that's bad, that's trash, that's, I wish there was more on it to kind of thicken it up. But Fast Car, in that moment, focused attention and actually had something worthwhile to look at, which, what a fortunate thing. Talking about a revolution, oh, no. Talking about a revolution,
oh, no. This year, a very important public figure turns 80. He sent us his wish for his birthday.
My wish is for everyone to practice wildfire safety, because only you can prevent wildfires.
That sounds easy enough. Bet you don't know who it is. Nah, of course you do. It's Smokey Bear. Let's all make sure Smokey's wish comes true by learning his wildfire prevention tips at SmokeyBear.com. Because Smokey Bear lives within us all. Brought to you by the USDA Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council.
Hi, it's Samantha Shea from Wirecutter, the product recommendation service from the New York Times. We all know those people who are simply impossible to shop for. At Wirecutter, we have a huge collection of gift guides to help you find the perfect present. We can help you find a gift for the indoorsy type, a gift for the coffee lover looking to try a new bean, something that's nice but not too nice for the new person you're seeing, the best packing cubes for frequent travelers, for the music-loving dad, try a Thelonious Monk album. We believe there's a perfect gift for everyone, and Wirecutter can help you find it. Check out all our gift guides at nytimes.com/giftguides.
This album also, I think, is maybe not as fully remembered for its social and political perspective. It's remembered as kind of narrative and storytelling, but there's a tremendous amount of socially progressive songwriting on this album. And I wonder, in your conversations with her, it comes up in your interview, but can you talk a little bit about how she spoke about art in relationship to the social circumstances of the day?
The album doesn't start with Fast Car. The album starts with talking about a revolution. I mean, it's basically, it's the politics of it all are right there. And when she was doing the live shows, then she would save most of that stuff for the end. But the end of the concert would be a lot of very pointed political songs. And she would talk about them. I remember at the time people were saying, oh, it's naive. She's saying, oh, the poor people are going to rise up. And she was very conscious of that. And she was very conscious of saying, look, I'm not being naive. I have lived this. And I think we're at a breaking point. And I'm singing what I see. So I don't know. I think she was very aware of what she was doing with these songs, that, you know, in a political way and in a social way, you know, and clearly that was a very important part for her of what she was trying to do. I mean, that was certainly as important as relationship songs or anything, you know. And Fast Car is a personal story, but it's a personal story about people who are forced into these circumstances who, you know, who may not see a way out.
Did she talk about the music as a reaction to some of the other things that were prevailing in that time period, whether it's very digital and synthetic orchestration or pop, the pop music of Madonna, et cetera, which is like very highly sexualized and dance floor oriented. Did she talk about her music in existing in the same spaces as those kinds of records? Or did she just see it in its own little cloistered space?
She did say she didn't grow up listening to folk music. It's not like she was listening to whoever, Joni Mitchell or whatever. I mean, she was talking about listening to Gladys Knight and Barbara Streisand and the Bee Gees and Neil Diamond. And her mom was playing sort of everything. I think she said something about my sister even played Journey at one point. So her background was not like, oh, I'm going to study the great folk music. Her background was, here's all this popular music. And I think she was coming out of that, but she was coming out of that into basically a coffee house tradition. I mean, that's where she was playing her songs, coffee houses and rallies.
The Wembley show becomes like, I mean, nowadays it's a viral moment, but then that was, you know, there's no virality, but it was something that took it from here's a performance of a person who has a modestly performing debut album that people seem to dig, but is not very popular, to all of a sudden you're on the road for 4 days. What exactly was it about that performance that was so galvanizing?
I think you have to give credit to Elliot Roberts for part of that. It's like a new artist who just put out an album is not going to get on a show at Wembley Stadium in honor of Nelson Mandela unless they've got a real powerful manager behind them who everybody respects to get her on there. And then I think it was just, A, she was sort of a surprise to most people who were watching, and B, she was absolutely the perfect artist for that day in whatever setting. I mean, you're doing a concert for Nelson Mandela and you put a young Black woman singing songs that are that powerful that people haven't heard before and doing it quietly. It was just sort of this perfect storm of, I don't know. I mean, it was absolutely right for that moment. And it was the kind of thing that everybody recognized it when they saw it.
One of the things that comes up later in your piece is this idea of Tracy reckoning with an audience that maybe she didn't anticipate would be her audience, which is to say either reasonably well-to-do white liberals or at the very end, like young people who think, hey, you're a rock star. I like you. You're a big deal. Two different things, but maybe neither of those things are groups that she had anticipated cultivating. In the same way that she had some anxiety about being a public figure and being recognized, you talked to her about some of the anxiety that goes with, are the people who are listening to the songs the people who the songs are for? And I wonder if you can get into that a little bit, because that's a universal time-worn tension for a lot of artists. But for someone like her, succeeding so quickly with such a particular point of view, but succeeding at such scale, must have been very destabilizing.
Yeah, I think it was. When I started talking to her about it, she did say, yeah, I've had that question before. How do I feel about my yuppie audience? And
yuppies, kids, yuppies, look it up.
Right. But yeah, I mean, all the shows I saw her do, it was a white audience, varying ages. And she said, look, I can't control who consumes my music. I don't know if they're yuppies. I know they have enough money to buy concert tickets. And there was a sense that she was dealing with that. She was thinking about that. There was talk that her audience is using her music to make themselves feel better. They're sympathizing with the disenfranchised by listening to Tracy Chapman. And obviously, she's not in it to do that. But, you know, I think there's a sense of, I want people to listen. Am I going to complain about who is listening or why they're listening? If they are listening, she's accomplishing something. And I think that was sort of the way that she dealt with it, by saying, I want people to listen to the music and listen to what I have to say. And I'm not going to quibble about exactly who they are, even if it's not who I wrote this for.
She said something that I thought was really fascinating, talking about the kind of image of the female folk singer, I assume going back to the 60s and 70s. And I'll read this quote because I thought it was both incredibly astute about the decades prior and also incredibly prescient about, frankly, how a lot of young female performers, especially in guitar traditions, are still written about and thought about today. So Tracy says, it seems to me that that image, so talking about, you say, female folkies have traditionally been painted as vulnerable, fragile creatures singing about their loves and fears. And you say Chapman trashes that stereotype. And her quote is, it seems to me that image was created for female folk singers because they actually had a lot more control than other women in the music scene. They wrote their own songs. They played them. They performed by themselves. There you have a picture of a very independent person, and trying to make them seem emotional and fragile and all puts a softer edge on it, as if there was something wrong with being independent. a very, very striking read on something that I think maybe is not as discussed about the folk singers of the 60s and 70s. And if anything, I asked before, was she painting herself in opposition to the pop music of the day? But this is actually the thing in your story where I was like, okay, so she is somewhat painting in opposition to something, but it is against a male-dominated or male-written idea of how female singer-songwriters had been encouraged or perhaps forced to present themselves. That seems to be, if she's pushing back against anything, rather than just coming fully formed out the womb, it's that. How does that strike you?
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think she was saying that, you know, and I've had conversations with Joni Mitchell where she will say something similar, that people would approach her music in a way that, you know, if it registered with them, they could say, oh, she's going through what we're going through. And if it didn't, oh, that's just her thing. She's just singing about her. I mean, there's always a way in which female folk singers have been viewed. They've been viewed in a way that limits them. And I think Tracy is and was smart enough to recognize that and to say, okay, these are my songs, but I'm going to make it harder for you to view me through this same lens that you're used to viewing women with an acoustic guitar.
In a place that's warm and dark, in a place where I can feel the beating of your heart.
The questions around retirement have gotten tiring. Instead of, have you saved up enough? Shouldn't they be asking, what is it that you love to do? You're not slowing down. So your retirement plan should be more of an action plan, a hiking plan, a golf plan. Lincoln Financial has the products to help protect and grow your financial future. Make your pastimes last a lifetime at lincolnfinancial.com/action plan. Lincoln Financial Group, marketing name for Lincoln National Corporation and its insurance companies and broker-dealer affiliate, Lincoln Financial Distributors, Inc., 2024, Lincoln National Corporation.
Was there anything, I mean, you said you double reviewed it, but really in 88 or 89, was there anything else happening that you felt that this really had kinship with?
In the review I wrote, I tried to find some kinship with Tony Child's first album because that was the assignment.
Wait, it was not your choice? That's how it was given to you?
The reviews editor came to me and said, let's do these two albums together. And I liked the Tony Child's album, but it was very much different. It was very much a female singer aiming sort of for Van Morrison kind of territory. It was much more produced. So I spent more of the review pointing out the differences between them than the similarities. I think it was a very singular album to come out at that particular time. And I'm sure that there, if I were to go back now and look at everything that came out in 1988, there would probably be some where I thought, okay, there's a kinship.
I mean, am I crazy to say Public Enemy?
No.
I mean, obviously the texture, the genre, I mean, they like all the kind of like above the fold references are different, but the agitation, the sense of political dis-ease, social awareness, a lot of what Tracy was doing, this is also a really rich era in socially aware hip hop, whether it's PE or the beginning of the Native Tongues. Like, that to me, when I was thinking of what was happening in 88, that could have gone hand in hand with that, with this.
That would have been a more interesting double review.
Real talk. Reviews editors take note. Right. Genre is a construct. Jeez.
And in a way, it was sort of limiting what Rolling Stone did with like, oh, here are two female singer-songwriters. Let's put them together. So yeah, it probably would have been more worthwhile to look for the kind of connections you're talking about.
Seeing a Black woman, a solo Black young performer on the cover of Rolling Stone, frankly, still feels radical in 2024. Can you give a sense at the time, how unusual was that? How unexpected was that?
It was unusual. I mean, first of all, it was unusual that somebody that early in their career would be on the cover. I mean, I went back yesterday knowing I was going to do this and looked at what artists on their first albums were on the cover of Rolling Stone in that era. To find somebody who was on the cover that early in their career, that soon after their first album. You actually have to go back to the Sex Pistols, who were on the cover before their first album came out.
Wow.
Everybody else, it took some time after the first album came out for Rolling Stone to acknowledge it. 5 years before this, I did a story on the Go-Go's, and Rolling Stone had decided to probably put them on the cover after their first album. But the cover story didn't come out until they were releasing their second album. So to have somebody on the cover, regardless of race, was to have them on the cover that soon in their career was very unusual. And look, this was the 80s. Rolling Stone did not put a lot of black artists on the cover.
They sure didn't.
Prince and Michael Jackson wouldn't talk to Rolling Stone. So I think Prince made it once and Michael made it. You had some others. Generally, I mean, around that time, I think like Robert Cray was on the cover and Terence Trent D'Arby was on the cover and a few people like that. I think the year after Tracy, I did a story on the Fine Young Cannibals and Roland Gift was on the cover. But typically Rolling Stone was not, they were mostly ignoring hip hop. I think Run DMC made the cover, but not until 1989 or something, which you could argue they should have been on there a long time before that.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. 86 at minimum 86. But yeah,
it was unusual just to have a black artist, period, on the cover. And it was very unusual to have somebody that early in their career on the cover.
Is there anything about the current Fast Car moment that has jumped out at you now that you see what's happening? I imagine you watched the Grammys performance or have seen it.
I did.
Is there anything about this that has struck you with the historical knowledge you have?
When I heard the Luke Combs version for the first time, it was like, okay, it's a great song and he knows it, so he's not trying to do anything with it.
Yeah. He sure isn't.
Right. It's like, you know.
It's okay. It's a safe space. It's a critic's first podcast. It's a safe right. space.
Is there a reason for his version to exist? Not really. But, you know, it turns out the reason for his version to exist is that moment on the Grammys. I mean, as soon as she came on, it was like, wow, she sounds great. She looks great. Her presence up there, you know, as everybody who was watching the show, no, I mean, it was such a great moment to see her have that platform and to see her. It's like, oh yeah, we've missed her. And, you know, and I know she has been around here and there. I mean, I remember seeing the Mr. Rogers movie, Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, and they used the song The Promise late in that film. And it was great in that when they dropped it in there. So I think we've always kind of missed her. And I thought that was an amazing Grammy moment.
No, and I think you're right. Like sometimes it takes a younger reinterpreter, whether through a cover or often increasingly through sampling or interpolation, but to draw these kind of like historical consonants between generations or genres. And like, you know, anyone who's listened to Popcast for the last 3 months knows perfectly well, like I don't have a lot of time for the Luke Combs version. It just doesn't do anything for me. I sort of agree with you. It's flat. It doesn't add much. It doesn't need to exist. But I do think you're right to reframe it and say it exists because it draws attention to this original song. And then it exists because it then allows that to be replatformed and shared and appreciated anew. And if that's what it takes, well, then salute.
Right. The Grammys were not going to invite Tracy Chapman on to perform, except that Luke Combs had a hit with hers. And they were smart enough not to ask him just to come on and do his song by himself.
Oh, yeah. No, we wouldn't. No, I would have been writing a whole notebook about that. You kidding me? I'd have been up till 5 a.m. that night. That just been no. Steve, I really appreciate you getting into the weeds with me on this. This is really fun stuff, and I think people will be really excited to hear it. Before I let you go, who's going to win Best Picture?
Oppenheimer.
Really?
It's sort of been the front runner for a long time, and in recent years, the front runners haven't won, but this year, I just don't see what can beat it.
Well, as a I'm just Ken stan over here, that's challenging news for me to hear, but I accept your proclamation.
Hey, maybe I'm wrong.
You never know. Maybe a Barbenheimer tie.
Right.
Could happen. Steve, appreciate you so much.
Thanks a lot.
That is our show. Thank you to Steve Pond. Every podcast ever is at nytimes.com/podcast, which I made a Zazzle I know people have been asking for mugs, tote bags, whatever, etc. I don't know. I just figured, what the hell? Let's make a Zazzle. If you type Popcast in a Zazzle, there's a few different options on there with the logo, with the Popcast logo from the t-shirts. There may be more t-shirts later in the year, but for now, I didn't want to be in the mug shipping business. So if you would like a Popcast mug, which a lot of you have expressed interest in, go ahead and type Popcast into Zazzle. You'll find it. It's the popcast.myshopify.com. That's where the stickers and the remaining t-shirts are. YouTube.com/popcast. That is where Joe and I are on Deluxe every week. TikTok.com/popcast deluxe. That is our clip account. Instagram is at Popcast Deluxe. Follow us both of those places if you'd like to see us in talking head format. Discord, Facebook, tinyurl.com/popcast discord and Popcast Facebook. And email us at always as popcast@nytimes.com if you have questions or for future mailbag episodes. I'll be on the lookout for that. We'll be back next week. Our producer, as always, is Pedro Rosado from Headsever Media. Let's go out with a little bit later Tracy Chapman. This was another big hit, maybe the last big Tracy Chapman hit, but still sounds. I'm wondering which country singer is going to cover this song. It's called Give Me One Reason. Actually, Beyonce should cover this song. Let's just put it out there. Beyonce should cover this. Tracy Chapman, Give Me One Reason. See you next week.
Baby, I got your number.
NetCredit is here to say yes, because you're more than a credit score. Apply in minutes and get a decision as soon as the same day. Loans offered by NetCredit or lending partner banks and serviced by NetCredit. Application subject to review and approval. Learn more at netcredit.com/partners. NetCredit. Credit to the people.